From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The Zika virus is named after a forest in Uganda, where it was first discovered, identified in 1947. It's a long way from Uganda now. Mosquito-borne, it's exploded in Brazil and moved rapidly north through Latin America, the Caribbean. The CDC is now advising pregnant women to avoid 14 countries, including Puerto Rico, Haiti, Mexico. The fear, serious birth defects in newborns. This hour on Point, all about the Zika virus and where it's headed. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you reading the reports of more cases of Zika showing up in the United States? Pregnant women, women trying to become pregnant, are you changing travel plans? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will look at the vice president's moonshot initiative to find a cure for cancer. But first, Zika. Joining me first today from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, really the epicenter of the outbreak in the Western Hemisphere, is Lourdes Garcia Navarro, South American correspondent for NPR News. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
We've followed your reporting with great interest, Lourdes, and Brazil's grappling with this. I mean, I'm reading here that before May of last year, the only place in the entire Western Hemisphere where the Zika had been seen was on Easter Island. And then last year, something between 500,000 and 1.5 million residents infected in Brazil. And along with that, this microcephaly, the small head and serious brain problems. Brazil had seen something like 150 a year. Last year, they saw 3,500 babies born with the condition. What's happening, Lourdes?
Yeah, there are about 3,500 cases in the country as of last week. Actually, 3,530 to be exact. I just traveled to one of the hardest hit areas, Natal in Brazil's north. It's a pretty desperate situation. The National Health Service is overwhelmed and underprepared for so many infants now born with severe disabilities, microcephaly, as you mentioned. And some of the families are actually blaming the government for being in this position. You know, one of the mothers that I spoke with contends that the authorities have only been half-heartedly trying to eradicate the mosquito that carries Zika and dengue and chikungunya. These are all sort of viruses that are very, very prevalent in Brazil. You know, last year, 1.5 million people had dengue in Brazil. This year, we're seeing possibly similar numbers for Zika. So it is a really, really serious situation. And there is a massive eradication campaign underway here. They've drafted in the army. They're using drones. They're funding research into Zika. Brazil is really, really taking this extremely seriously.
There is no vaccine for this. There is no medical treatment for it, really. The effects for the mother pass quickly. The effects for the children, if they're affected, devastating. So what does eradication mean? They're trying to eradicate the mosquito that carries this?
Absolutely. The mosquito that carries this is the Aedes aegypti. It is a mosquito that, as I mentioned, carries a number of different illnesses, chikungunya. It also carries dengue and now Zika. When Zika first appeared here, many of the doctors basically thought that it was a fairly benign illness. They hadn't yet to make the link with cases of microcephaly. So basically they were telling people, hey, it's not a big deal. You're going to be sick for a few days and then it doesn't seem to have any lasting effects, so don't worry about it. That was indeed what happened to one of the mothers that I spoke to. She was infected with Zika. The doctors weren't very familiar with the disease. It was something that is believed to have shown up during the World Cup, and nobody knows really how it traveled to these shores, although there are many theories. But it spread very, very quickly. And that, it is believed, is because, you know, Brazil has the perfect sort of place for this kind of mosquito to breed and to survive. It has very densely populated areas. It's very wet. And so it really is a place where you need to constantly combat this mosquito in order to get control of the situation. And what some of these mothers and other critics say is that the Brazilian government had not been doing that, and now they have been left with this very, very desperate situation.
When it travels, Lourdes, how does that happen? I've seen this reference to the World Cup. Of course, Rio has the Olympics coming up, the Summer
Indeed.
Olympics coming up this year. Is this blood, it travels, I mean, people say it's related to air travel. Someone who's infected gets on an airplane, goes somewhere else, mosquito bites them, it gets into the local population. Is that the way?
Well, I think that right now what they're doing is really trying to figure it out. You know, it is extraordinary that only, you know, just over a year ago, we had the World Cup here, and now there may be as many as a million cases of Zika in Brazil. I mean, it's just an enormous expansion in a very short amount of time. So they are trying to understand exactly how this is transmitted. Clearly, what they believe at this point is that, yes, someone who is infected with Zika could have traveled here, was then bitten by another mosquito, that mosquito got infected, and then it just kind of spread. But, you know, they're really trying to understand how this is transmitted, also why this is affecting the northeast of Brazil so much as opposed to other areas of the country. You know, this has really hit the northeast hardest of all. That's where most of the microcephaly cases linked to Zika have been have happened. So it really is right now, it's a race against time. You have many different groups right now studying the virus and really trying to understand why this is happening.
The northeast, of course, a particularly hot and wet part of Brazil, close to the equator there.
Yes, hot and wet. And also, it's been suffering a devastating drought for quite some time, which is why they link the spread of this particular mosquito to climate change. We have been seeing erratic weather all over Brazil, droughts. And so people have been storing water at home. And this is really one of the worst things that you can do. I've been out with some of these eradication teams and, you know, they basically have to go house to house. It's painstaking. They knock on doors and they inspect, you know, everything in the house. They try and see where these mosquitoes could be breeding. And you find them in the most unlikely places. People all of a sudden might have left a flower pot and it's rained and all of a sudden some water's collected there. And lo and behold, you'll find the mosquito larvae inside. So it really is something that requires a great deal of effort to combat.
I mean, and how to deal with this? I'm seeing health officials in Brazil, also in Jamaica and elsewhere, telling women to avoid pregnancy. But pregnancy is sort of what humans do, Lourdes. I mean, how do you avoid pregnancy for how long? This eradication campaign presumably could take years.
Well, they're working in many different... First of all, they really are trying to find a virus. They say that that is
a vaccine.
The most, a vaccine, rather. Excuse me. Thank you. They're trying to find a vaccine. That is, of course, the most efficient way of combating this. If you can have a vaccine, then you can vaccinate the population, and then it won't be such a concern. But that will take some time, and so they are trying to really trying to hit the mosquito and trying to stop it breeding as much as it has been. You know, we're about to see Carnival here. It is the rainy season. Millions of people out on the street. There is, you know, a grave concern amongst health officials that I've spoken to, the Carnival, and then again with the Olympics could really allow this to further get out of control. Having visited some of these moms, though, I have to say it's devastating for them. These are people who just thought they were going to have a healthy pregnancy. They happen to have been bitten by a mosquito, and then they find that their child has these severe disabilities. And so it is heartbreaking.
The Olympics coming up this summer. Are Brazilian officials afraid that people won't come from abroad for fear of Zika?
I think so. Very, very much so. I think that's one of the main concerns. You know, Brazil, as you know, is going through a very difficult economic patch. There's also a political crisis here, and it just feels like this is like now a biblical plague of mosquitoes. I mean, you know, Brazilians that I spoke to just joked, like, how many more bad things can the country suffer? And this is a big worry. You know, the Olympics is a big moment for Brazil. Rio de Janeiro, of course, is hosting it. It's hoping that millions of people will come and enjoy and celebrate the games. And now what you have is, you know, many, or, you know, even Brazil itself saying women should be careful. They might, you know, they shouldn't get pregnant. They shouldn't travel perhaps around the country to areas that are being affected this way, because indeed your child could be severely damaged as far as we know right now.
Lourdes Casir Navarro in Rio de Janeiro, South America correspondent for NPR. Thanks so much for joining us, Lourdes.
You're welcome.
Last month, she talked with Dr. Angela Roja for NPR's All Things Considered. Here, the doctor in Brazil explaining the urgency of tracking Zika.
I've never been through such a period of stress, she told us. If we don't get a handle on this, we could have a generation of damaged babies.
The CDC now advising pregnant women or women who might want to get pregnant not to travel to the following countries: Brazil, it's a lot, Colombia, El Salvador, French Guinea, Guyana, Guatemala, Haiti, Honduras, Martinique, Mexico, Panama, Paraguay, Suriname, and Venezuela. Disease also been found in Puerto Rico. With us right now in Galveston, Texas, is Scott Weaver, director of the Institute for Human Infections and Immunity at the University of Texas Medical Branch, professor of pathology, microbiology, immunology. Scott Weaver, thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
What are the symptoms if someone acquires the Zika virus?
Well, all of the information we've obtained so far indicates that the majority of infected people, probably 4 out of 5, have no symptoms at all from Zika virus. They don't even realize that they're infected. And then typically the 1 in 5 persons who does become symptomatic has a nonspecific flu-like illness where they have fever, a headache, body aches, often a rash, and conjunctivitis, which leads to a red appearance of the eyes. But this is a relatively mild disease that is self-limited. It usually lasts only a few days and then people recover completely. It's only two of these unusual outcomes, the microcephaly, as well as another neurologic disease called Guillain-Barré syndrome that's also been associated with Zika virus infection that can be life-threatening.
Is the connection with microcephaly confirmed, Dr. Weaver?
Well, in only a few of these cases has the virus actually been detected either in amniotic fluid or in fetal tissues through a test called the polymerase chain reaction or other genetic tests. So in the vast majority, there's not a direct link through a laboratory test. But I think that the circumstantial evidence, the overwhelming connection in both time and space between where Zika virus is circulating and where these microcephaly cases are appearing is very strong evidence that probably many, most of these cases are caused by Zika virus.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Zika virus on the move in Latin America and now hitting Americans who have traveled there, fears of it coming north, fears for pregnant women, fears of birth defects. You can join the conversation this hour. Can you see a reason that it won't end up in mosquitoes in the United States? Are you headed to the Summer Olympics in Rio? Are you worried about what you'll find there, face there with Zika? And are we going to face more of these mosquito-borne diseases in more of the United States as the climate changes, warms? What's your question for our epidemiologist, our pathologist on Zika? Here's CBS reporter Dr. Jonathan LaPook on the CDC travel warning.
The CDC is advising pregnant women to avoid travel to 14 countries and territories in Latin America and the Caribbean, including Puerto Rico, Mexico, and Haiti.
And his reporter Danielle Knox of 7 News in Miami-Fort Lauderdale reporting on the 3 cases found just this week in South Florida.
Zika is the latest mosquito-borne illness to arrive on U.S. shores and now here in South Florida. We note the local cases are from Miami-Dade and Hillsborough counties. The 2 Miami-Dade cases contracted the Zika virus while traveling in Colombia in December. A third person in Hillsborough contracted it while traveling in Venezuela in December.
Scott Weaver joins us from the University of Texas Medical Branch. He's in Galveston, Texas, a professor of pathology, microbiology, immunology, all over this. Heidi Brown joins us in just a moment. A call for you, Scott. Teresa in Burlington, Vermont. Thank you for calling, Teresa. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is such a great conversation, and I'm so glad you guys are having it. It's kind of funny because my father and I plan a trip with my husband to Mexico this spring, and he's been really sending me articles weekly about this virus, and he's really concerned because me and my husband are almost 30. We haven't had a child yet, and he is really worried that if we go and I catch this, that it may affect my future childbearing abilities. So he really is kind of on the fence about going. So I guess my question is, how long does this virus last in your body? And, you know, 2 years from now, will I still have a problem if, say, I contract this?
It's a great question, Teresa, and I appreciate your raising it. Scott Weaver, speak to Teresa. Thinking about headed to Mexico, 30, thinking about at some point being pregnant, and you hear her question, how long does the risk last if she should get the Zika virus?
Well, probably there's no long-term risk of the virus affecting your fertility. At least there's no evidence yet of that. So the main risk is that if you were infected while you were in Mexico and you were pregnant at that time or became pregnant within a few days of that time, perhaps while the virus is still infecting your body, then it's possible that could trigger the microcephaly condition. Now, the virus is not circulating in all parts of Mexico yet, And there are some regions of Mexico, high altitude, for example, where there's no history of these kinds of viruses circulating. So what's important is for you to be very specific in looking at your risk in the part of Mexico where you're going. But I think that the virus is going to be spreading very quickly through Mexico, and I would advise very strongly that you postpone your trip. If you're going to an area of Mexico that either has Zika virus present now or has a history of dengue or chikungunya viruses, these are other mosquito-borne viruses that we think will predict for us exactly where Zika will go. If you're going to any of those regions and there's a chance you would be pregnant, I would certainly encourage you to postpone your trip.
But Dr. Weaver, let's get very specific here for Teresa. Let's say if she went to Mexico and came back, how long would you advise her to wait before getting pregnant to be clear of all risk on this front?
Well, if she became infected in her last day in Mexico, for example, the incubation period for the virus before symptoms appear and before virus is circulating the bloodstream can be up to about 12 days. And then that phase where the virus is still present in the body can last another week or perhaps longer. So probably there would be a period of time of about 3 weeks, and she could get tested when she returned to the U.S. if she was concerned about this. And the CDC is actually advising that just today. But the real risk would be that period of about 3 weeks.
Teresa, I hope that's helpful for you and your family. Let's go to Art in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Art, you're on the air.
Hi. I went to a recent presentation on global warming, and there was some emphasis on this issue and that this may be another example of how global warming can affect people in the U.S. and the spread of the mosquitoes and the virus here. So that's one question. And the other is, I noticed that on your list of a dozen countries, Cuba is not one of them, although many countries are in Cuba is, and they've been very aggressive in fighting dengue. So I'm wondering what, if anything, you know about Cuba's role in trying to attack and prevent this spread.
Both great questions. Thank you very much, Art. To go to those, let me bring in, if I may, Heidi Brown, professor of epidemiology at the University of Arizona. She's a vector-borne disease epidemiologist, focuses on diseases carried by arthropods, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, also studies the effects of climate on diseases. She's with us from Tucson, Arizona. Heidi Brown, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You hear Art's first question, climate change and Zika, diseases like Zika, and Zika in particular. Do you see it affecting the spread of the area in which this is present? Could climate change help bring it to the United States?
Yeah, I think that's one of the questions that a lot of people are asking and trying to really understand what's going on. The way that we think about it potentially having an effect is it's climate change is affecting the vector and how many, so the abundance, how quickly it develops, and how long it survives. Temperature also has an effect on virus replication and how quickly that happens, which is how quickly a mosquito becomes then infected. And it also has some impact on us and what we're doing, our activities, whether we're spending more time outdoors, indoors, which is the number of people that are potentially infected and then infecting mosquitoes or being infected by them. So I think it's all of those things that are getting people kind of concerned. And when we think about these diseases, vector-borne diseases are most certainly linked to climate. And so then we can go forward from that to say that, well, if they're linked to climate, as the climate starts changing, we might expect to see some of these changes.
Help us with the medical scientific language. Is the vector the mosquito or the virus?
Sorry about that. Yeah, the vector, at least in the way that I'm using it today, it's the mosquito. And I'll try to switch to mosquito.
That's okay. That's fine.
Thanks.
How much of the United States might be vulnerable to seeing mosquitoes carrying this? Are we talking Florida, just southern Florida? Are we talking Texas, Gulf Coast? Where?
Well, that's one of the really interesting things about it is I think the CDC has some great maps showing both Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus, and both of these are vectors for
these are the kinds of mosquitoes who carry dengue and Zika and more.
Yes, exactly. And if you look at those maps here in Arizona, I'm like you said, I'm down in Tucson. We have Aedes aegypti in this area. Albopictus is also down along the southern border, and even kind of goes up along the east coast.
How far north?
The last time I looked at the map, I believe it goes all the way up into New York, but somebody might want to check me on that one.
And how does, let's say, Zika get into that mosquito population? How would that happen? I mean, a year ago, it wasn't in the Western Hemisphere except Easter Island. That's 2,000 miles from South America. Now it's in 14 countries. How does it happen? How does it work?
Yeah, it's pretty astonishing of how quickly it's moved. Chikungunya is the same sort of an example, came in and really quickly blew through the Caribbean. I think, as Lourdes kind of alluded to, we're still trying to figure out exactly how it got and how it moved. In this area, we have Aedes aegypti, we have Aedes albopictus, so we have the vectors. And so it's kind of this perfect storm of somebody coming, most likely somebody coming into the area and then infecting mosquitoes, and then it was able to then proliferate. And, you know, we move a lot. We've become a really connected society, and we move through areas, and so we're kind of helping spread this virus along.
Two women in Illinois found. So presumably they come, it's in them. If someone is then bitten by a mosquito and that bites somebody else, is that how, Scott, is that how transmission takes place?
Exactly. We think that the vast majority of these outbreaks are begun when an air traveler arrives, often from halfway around the world. We think that Zika came in from probably South Pacific. And again, it only takes one person who either doesn't even recognize they're infected or doesn't protect themselves from mosquito bites while they're in this phase with virus in their bloodstream. And then only one mosquito can bite that person, and after an incubation period in the mosquito, can transmit to multiple people, and then the outbreak can explode, as we've seen in Brazil, and continue spreading probably mainly through air travel.
So some thought that the World Cup, when so many people descended on Brazil from all over the place, may have been related to bringing this in, and boom, they've got maybe a million, maybe more cases there. Olympics now coming up again in Brazil, in Rio, though in their winter, though we call them the Summer Olympics. Jen in Nashville. Jen, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
I had a question. I was wondering if anyone had looked at whether, if a male became infected, whether the virus could be transmitted to the fetus during conception.
Scott?
Yes, actually, that evidence just came to light a few years ago through a case of a scientist who was infected by this virus in West Africa and returned to Colorado and then transmitted the virus to his wife, who had no travel history. So we now have direct evidence that Zika virus can be present for quite a while in the semen of men who are infected and presumably can be transmitted sexually. And then we also know now that the virus can persist in the saliva, so there's the potential for oral transmission as well, although the epidemiologic evidence so far suggests that the vast majority of the transmission is through mosquitoes.
Wow. So the answer is yes, that if the man gets the virus, that can be transmitted to a sexual partner.
That's right. It's assumed that that's how this particular infection happened, although it can't be ruled out that that was oral transmission as well.
Or saliva. Wow, amazing. Jen, there's an answer for you. Alex in Brookline, Massachusetts. Alex, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Okay. A little freaked out, but okay.
Well, actually, don't. I just came back from Colombia. I went to visit my family, and I took my son. And I had a friend of the family back there, and she said, you know, just take vitamin V1 because it'll work like some sort of like repellent. Mm-hmm. And I came back and I'm fine. And I guess I didn't face any mosquitoes. But I don't know what if that was a good thing. But I took before I was
vitamin
there.
B1, you're saying, Alex.
B1, yes.
Let me take it up with our professionals here. Heidi, vitamin B1, and you've got a prophylactic, or is that an old wives' tale?
That would be new to me. I've not heard that. Most of the protection that I think about with these mosquitoes is source reduction around your home and trying to protect yourself, so long sleeves and some sort of a repellent on exposed skin.
Heidi, the speed of the spread of this in Latin America is really pretty astonishing. We heard Lourdes Garcia Navarro in Brazil saying that they're looking at eradication, but that's tough. What does is eradication the number one response at this point without a vaccine, and what would that require?
Ooh, that's a big question. We tried it. We tried it in the 30s and 40s and knocked back Aedes aegypti. But then a population started to crash. We figured we don't have a problem anymore, and we stopped doing it, and they came back.
Is that back when the trucks used to rumble through town, putting out clouds of, I don't know what, DDT, some chemical?
Yeah, that's back in the day when they were really trying aggressively going at it, mm-hmm. and it was, you know, cross countries, multinational, really trying to work to get this mosquito knocked back, and like I said, it came back, and so. The reason that we're thinking about eradication and trying to go back after the mosquito is as you said, there's not a vaccine, and it's challenging, quite challenging to make a vaccine, especially if you're thinking about also dengue and chikungunya. So you have multiple vaccines that you need to be thinking about. So that's the way that we're thinking about it, is going to the vector and trying to see what we can do there.
But does that mean blanketing communities, whole states with chemicals to kill these mosquitoes? Is there another way?
So we're getting more surgical, I guess, is the way we kind of think about that, is trying to get more pinpoint on it and looking at it from that aspect. So these mosquitoes are quite challenging in terms of where they breed. So when you're trying to blanket fogging, you end up getting a lot of other things as well,
yeah.
And even missing some of the places where you have them. They tend to hang out in sort of eaves, or they'll in small water mm-hmm. sources. So, like was mentioned about
hard to get.
The saucer under your flower pot. You'll find them in there. So, the blanket chemical is probably not. So, trying to go more surgical on that and get into those.
Catherine in Columbia, Missouri. Catherine, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I had a question about the concern of the virus spreading to the southern United States, because I'm recently pregnant and I'm planning a trip to Florida in February, and the timing of all of this may be a little suspect. I know the CDC isn't advising against travel to the southern United States at this time, but I wondered what your experts thought about that.
We'll pick it up. Heidi, what about Cuba? We got a question earlier. And what about Florida for Catherine?
Well, I think both of us, probably Professor Weaver is going to want to chime in on this one as well. My first instinct is to remind you that for right now, we haven't seen any local transmission of Zika here in the United States. We can take, again, chikungunya as an example. We had quite a few travel-associated cases, but Florida did actually have some local transmission. So when we're thinking about southern Florida, it's kind of whether or not it's going to get out into that mosquito population, and we haven't seen that quite yet.
Okay.
As far as Cuba, I don't have any firsthand information on that, but certainly Cuba has been quite effective in some of their dengue work. So that might be a reason that it's not on the list. But I don't know.
Scott Weaver, a vaccine sure sounds like a great idea. We've got callers who know the medical world saying there is not grant money available to study the Zika virus, not enough from the NIH. What do you know on that front?
Well, that's not really correct. It is true that because this virus has been so obscure until very recently, the NIH in the past has not funded research on Zika, and probably nobody has even applied for funding. But now, actually, the NIH is mobilizing very quickly to fund Zika research. They're doing this by supplementing ongoing projects on things like dengue and chikungunya. And they'll be requesting applications for Zika-specific projects in upcoming cycles of funding. So I think we'll see a year from now, we'll see a lot of Zika research ramping up very quickly in the U.S.
Let's hope
Developing a vaccine for Zika, we know based on experience of developing vaccines for other flaviviruses like dengue, we have a good idea what may work for making a Zika vaccine, but any of these vaccines take many years and typically hundreds of millions of dollars of commercial investment before they can be licensed and available for use. So we won't be seeing a Zika vaccine anytime soon.
Wow. Lifting the curtain, and there's a lot to look at there. Scott Weaver at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Heidi Brown at the University of Arizona in epidemiology there, thank you so much for being with us from Tucson, Heidi.
Thanks for your interest.
We will stay on top of Zika. We're going to take a short break here, come back, and look at Joe Biden's moonshot push for a cancer cure. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
Hi, it's Tom. With a quick heads up for you, be sure to stay with us to the end of this podcast for a sneak preview of Modern Love. It's WBUR's new podcast put together in collaboration with the New York Times. You may want to check it out. Thanks. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. Like many others, Vice President Joe Biden has seen his family hit by cancer. Biden's 46-year-old son, Beau, died last year from brain cancer. Since Beau's death, Joe Biden has spoken of his dedication to finding a cure. Last week, President Obama made that official, putting the vice president in charge of a moonshot effort to tackle cancer, to find a cure. Biden's been meeting with scientists and doctors to discuss the realities of that goal. We've got two of them with us, and you can join us as well. Are you on board with this moonshot effort on cancer? Is it doable? Joe Biden's been talking about this for a while. In October, after he announced he would not seek the Democratic nomination for president, Biden talked about the fight against cancer.
I believe we need a moonshot in this country to cure cancer. It's personal. But I know we can do this.
Last week, in his State of the Union address, President Obama took him up on that.
Tonight, I'm announcing a new national effort to get it done. And because he's gone to the mat for all of us on so many issues over the past 40 years, I'm putting Joe in charge of mission control. For the loved ones we've all lost, for the families that we can still save, let's make America the country that cures cancer once and for all.
What do you say, Joe?
Make it happen.
For the loved ones we've all lost, for the families we can still save. Vice President Biden's been talking with a lot of people about this. We've got two of them with us today who've been talking with him. Joining me now from Davos, Switzerland, where just yesterday the vice president led a panel discussion on this push for a cure, is Paula Hammond. She was on the panel with the VP in Davos. She's with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Koch Institute for Integrative Cancer Research, head of the Department of Chemical Engineering at MIT. Her research looks at the nanotechnology and nanomedicine frontier. Paula Hammond, welcome to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi. And with us from Philadelphia is Dr. Carl June, professor of pathology and laboratory medicine at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, Beau Biden's school, director of translational research at the Abramson Cancer Center. His research looks at the potential of immunotherapy for treating cancer. He was one of the researchers that the vice president met last Friday to launch the Moonshot Initiative. Dr. Carl June, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Dr. June, I guess you were with one of the first groups that sat down since the State of the Union address with the vice president. What questions did he put to your group?
Well, you know, the vice president has been engaged in this now for months and months and has consulted with a number of stakeholders, you know, from around the country, both in academic centers as well as government and pharmaceutical industry. And I think, you know, he is looking for how can we take the toolbox that we have, which has never been so full with potential anti-cancer therapies, and accelerate, you know, the cure of cancer.
And did the group in the room with him there, I guess, say, yes, Mr. Vice President, we can do this, or we've been trying to do this for a long time, and it's wrong to talk about a cure for cancer. Can't be done.
So, you know, first of all, let me say that what we're saying and what he is saying is accelerate this, the C word, cure word. And I think with there are foxholes that exist within research groups, both between industry barriers, divides, to academic areas, to where the patients are on trials. And so if we can eliminate the stovepipes and have collaborative research rather than competitive research, I think that will accelerate the eventual eradication of cancer.
Paula Hammond in Davos, Switzerland. Could you hear the vice president's thinking moving forward? Here he was several days after his first panel sit down. Where was the edge of his inquiry when he met with you and others, Paula?
He was asking us to think about what kinds of barriers exist and what kinds of things could be done soon and in the near future that might change the pace at which we address cancer. And in that sense, I think that there were several ideas going around the room which relate to the number of rapid developments that have occurred in cancer in the last 2 years and how we can pull these capabilities together in a way that's much more effective.
I want to ask you about those. Let me ask you first just about the moonshot framing of this. Do you see this challenge, Paula Hammond, as parallel or comparable to the challenge of going to the moon?
Yes, I like the moonshot challenge. In fact, I think it's more than going to the moon. It's going to the moon and back. It's creating a permanent space station out there as well that allows us to continue to learn about some of the new approaches, because a number of the new developments that have occurred over the last 3 to 5 years, and we're still learning a huge amount about what we can do with precision medicine, what we can do with targeted delivery approaches, and what we can do with even some of the therapies that exist now and by using them in a more synergistic fashion. So trying to increase that expanse of knowledge while also putting together the things we already know.
Carl June, what's the central challenge when we think about curing cancer?
Well, you know, there are many different kinds of cancer, so there's not one shoe size that will fit all. I think for many years we didn't have really an understanding of the cause of cancer, and now I think with the genome cloning and cancer genome cloning, we now understand in many cases the fundamental cause. So now we have an approach actually that can be built, to prevent it or to cure it. So the essential challenges has been, in the past we didn't really know the cause, and now we have tools from a variety of points, from targeted precision medicines to immunotherapies, that I think in an orthogonal way can now bring control that we never thought possible.
Paula Hammond, what were some of the ideas that were put on the table in Davos where you met with the vice president? You said there are several there to speed the attack on cancer. Like what? What approaches, Paula?
One thing that was mentioned quite a bit was increased data sharing and finding ways to enable researchers across the board to access information anonymized about patients so that we can learn more about different genetic types of cancer and learn better approaches to them. There is also discussion about new approaches in general. For example, we heard about the possibilities of using genetic circuits, actually gene editing, the CRISPR technologies that have been developed to actually edit genes out, and what might in the very far future allow us to do this in vivo, in humans, to address something like cancer.
That is to edit genes that might leave individuals vulnerable to cancer.
That's right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And we also talked about using nanotechnologies, engineering techniques, to actually get drugs that are quite capable now but can't be used because they're too toxic into patients without putting them at risk. So there are a number of nanotechnologies and engineering approaches that really require that engineers, chemists, physicists, biologists, and clinicians work together to create an environment where we can innovate on ideas to deliver the drug as well as to develop new therapies.
Paula Hammond, Carl June, callers and questions for the two of you. Colin in Manchester, Connecticut. Colin, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just would like to say I wouldn't hold my breath for a cure for cancer coming out of the pharmaceutical countries or the companies, because cancer is such a huge industry. You'd be losing out billions of dollars. And there's a lot of talk about geoengineering things, and we're going to do nanotech, but nobody wants to talk about what we have access to now, which is using like endocannabinoids from industrial hemp production or the research done by Dr. Brzezinski using peptides that break down cancer cells, that currently has a lot of higher success rate than using chemo or radiation, which either kills your body or could possibly give you cancer.
Colin, let me look at this issue of vested interests. Carl June, what about it? Do you see a problem here with vested interests in the what our caller calls a very large cancer treatment industry at this point that would not really want to see a cure?
Well, I think, you know, we have a major issue, which is how you change, you know, the practice of medicine, the delivery of healthcare. We have now tools that we never had, and that can be, in principle, curative. So how those are installed into our healthcare system is actually a major problem, and it differs in different countries from both the U.S. to places where there are single-payer health systems and so on. And so that's an issue for healthcare economists.
Though, we'll keep an eye on that. Colin, I appreciate your call. Arthur in Easton, Connecticut. Arthur, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, thanks for a great show. You know, I'm a leukemia survivor and of a rare leukemia. My question to you and the panel is, you know, you said, hey, we can identify the problem now because of the genoning, which is fabulous and exciting. But one of the things I feel is stem cell research, having a disease, leukemia of the bone marrow, you know, when they knocked out the cancer, they knocked out IgG and IgA, which is 60 grand to replace every 3 weeks so I stay immune sufficient. So I'm thinking, hey, take some stem cells, put them in and grow them in me so they replace the... So the question is, and I know this has been the debate with Republicans, I don't want to make it political, but they would hold up stem cell research because of ethical reasons. So I'm curious about your take on it. Is there a promise there?
Arthur, we've got it. Paula Hammond, what about stem cell research and its applicability here and any possible political constraints on that front?
I think that stem cell research plays an important role in understanding cancer as well as in finding ultimately what might be a therapy. There are a number of stem cell therapies that are now being developed, which rely not only on embryonic stem cells, but also on induced pluripotent stem cells, which are derived from human stem cells, and helps to avoid some of these issues. I do think that for scientists to be able to address and understand what's going on with a number of diseases, cancer included, that access and the ability to work with these different kinds of cell types is really critical. But I will say that for addressing cancer, that there has been work looking at the kinds of processes that go on in tumor cells using stem cells as models. And there's also work looking at something like you mentioned, whether we can design or engineer stem cells as replacements. Another approach, of course, is to design therapies that don't destroy the immune system, but rather utilize it to address cancer in immunotherapy.
Is there an affordable way to go down this road? You hear our caller saying he dodged leukemia. He survived it, but $60,000 every 3 weeks to support his immune system, it makes this moonshot sound like if you do that times millions of people, you just can't afford it.
It's really something that has to be addressed and was definitely a topic at the discussion with Joe Biden. One of the concerns is healthcare costs. One of the things we have to weigh is whether we develop therapies that are manageable and also decrease the overall cost associated with cancer. There are a number of recent studies, for example, some of the immunotherapy studies and some of the studies that looked at genetic approaches in which the cost was about equal, even though the therapy itself was expensive, because the patient didn't suffer the same severe side effects and was not hospitalized as frequently. So if we look at the big picture and we begin to examine what the relative costs are, we may be able to balance them against each other. Certainly, we want to move beyond therapies that are so crippling that they lead to a need for huge cost post-care.
Max in Nashville, Tennessee. Max, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. So I'm a molecular geneticist who does work both in the diagnosis and research in different blood cancers, so various leukemias. And I think it's just, I think it's a mistake to try and say we're going to cure cancer and view it as a single disease. So cancer is really 100 different diseases. So it's really going to be more similar to, instead of going to the moon, going to all of the planets simultaneously. So I think there's a lack of understanding, both in the administration and possibly in the public's eye, of what an actual cure would be. So it's going to be various cures for various types of cancer. So it may be that we cure some in 5 years with various immunotherapies and cure some in 10 years with different small molecules. And so I think there just needs to be a clear understanding both, and there is at the NIH level, but in the administration and in the public's eye, of what exactly that would entail.
Max, I really appreciate your call. I mean, Carl June, once it's brought into the political arena, then it's a communication issue, among other things. All the research challenges are there. But when President John F. Kennedy said, we will go to the moon, everybody could see the moon. They knew what going to the moon meant. And we knew when it had been accomplished, you know, one small step and all that, plant the flag. Now, our caller in Nashville says, this isn't like going to the moon. This is like going to every planet. How will we know when this has been accomplished?
So, you know, the caller is 100% on target. A large effort in education of the public, the lay public, in science needs to be undertaken in order for them to understand. There will be many different approaches that will result in cures. We first need to get to Mars before we get to Saturn. So,
yeah, but the public, they have an innate wisdom, and if you don't bring the numbers down, you haven't succeeded. Is that it? Will it be numbers?
It's going to take, as he said, I mean, there will be cancers cured one at a time. I mean, leukemia now, for instance, is we've had 90% remission, complete remission rates, mm-hmm. which has never before been seen. But we haven't seen that in other tumors at this point. And we don't know whether that'll take 10 years, 5 years. You know, and I think the analogy to the space system is very good. We first went to the moon, and then we've made serious, you know, we've made progress, and that's what we'll see. And the public needs not to have overblown expectations, but clear understanding of the complexity of this undertaking.
You say moonshot. That has an implication. Did the vice president in Davos with you, Paula Hammond, talk a timetable? Just got a few seconds here.
First of all, he definitely addressed the fact that we're addressing many different diseases, and He did not talk about a specific timetable, but I think he wants to see a difference in his lifetime. And he said this is his lifelong commitment. And he also, I think, is very committed to eliminating the silos, and I think integrating all of the clinicians, researchers, and engineers will have an ultimate effect.
Paula Hammond in Davos, Switzerland, where she just met with the vice president at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Koch Institute for Integrative Cancer Research. Dr. Carl June at the University of Pennsylvania, Perelman School of Medicine. Our thanks to you both. This is On Point.
Let's face it. When have you ever been in a relationship that's gone as planned?
Sometimes I think about the vows my wife and I made to each other 28 years ago, and we're different people than we once were.
And I don't even like him, I said, wiping my tears. He's a liar. I can't spend the rest of my life with him.
Being wheeled into surgery like this, alongside a woman in a sexy dress, pretty much screamed sex injury.
Modern Love, the popular New York Times column, is coming to you as a podcast.
There is no good way to tell a new guy in your life that you're going blind.
Between these two genteel Southern ladies, our family became an old West town. It just wasn't big enough for both of them.
Starring some familiar voices.
Hey, this is Emmy Rossum.
Hi, this is Jason Alexander.
Hey, it's January Jones.
Hey, it's Judd Apatow here.
Modern Love will make you laugh.
Is everything all right up there?
It'll make you cry.
I started calling hospitals, then morgues.
It'll make you think.
We can't keep calling you daddy, he said, if you're gonna be a girl. It's too weird.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I'll be your host. Modern Love, the podcast, is a collaboration between The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. Stories of love, loss, and redemption.
You're off the hook, I said. No guilt.
I love you. I love you too.
Modern Love, a new episode every Thursday. Subscribe today on iTunes and fall in love at first listen.